From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A lot of viewers have gone all in for the bingeable Netflix series Making a Murderer. It's immersive, it's unpredictable, it challenges our presumptions on criminality, on justice. And there's something about 21st century life now that is pumping new life into stories like this. New tech has the power to turn over convictions. Social media has brought mass participation to whodunit series like The Jinx and Serial. And we're maybe more aware than ever of the flaws in our criminal justice system. This hour on Point, Making a Murderer, and our revived obsession with true crime. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you make of Stephen Avery's story in Making a Murderer? Does everyone now sort of have a vote, have a say? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us first today from Madison, Wisconsin, is Keith Findley, co-director of the Wisconsin Innocence Project at the University of Wisconsin Law School. At one point, he was Stephen Avery's attorney. Keith Findley, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the invitation.
Remind us here, we've got this 10-part series has jumped in on part of Stephen Avery's life, the prelude to this murder case. And, of course, he's serving life sentence now without possibility of parole in Wisconsin. Is a murder in 2005. The prelude to that is where you were involved with his exoneration based on DNA evidence in an earlier case. What did you do for Stephen Avery, Keith?
Stephen had been convicted of a 1985 attempted sexual assault and attempted murder in Manitowoc County based almost entirely on eyewitness identification evidence. We, through the Wisconsin Innocence Project, stepped into the case 15 years later and filed a motion for post-conviction DNA testing, arranged for the testing, got the court order, and the DNA test results came back showing conclusively that Stephen Avery was not the source of the biological evidence left collected in the rape kit. And in fact, even more dramatically perhaps, the DNA identified another individual, a guy named Gregory Allen, who was by then in prison serving a lengthy sentence for another sexual assault committed after this one, and who in every other way fit the profile and, in fact, was on the radar of law enforcement at the time that they were investigating that crime. But they simply overlooked him because they believed that Avery was their guy.
Now, that case is central to the case that's explored in so much depth in Making a Murderer, because Stephen Avery brought this $36 million suit against the deputies there, the law enforcement in Manitowoc County. And that's the backdrop to the next case. There's the murder of Teresa Halbach, which leads to his 2005 arrest. Her remains are found in the car lot junkyard that his family has, where he's been working. And the case, he's in prison serving a life sentence for that. The case is made essentially in this docuseries that was wrong as well. Are you persuaded, Keith?
You know, I don't know that I can say that I'm persuaded, not because I'm not persuaded, but simply because I don't know that any of us as viewers can possibly know enough just from watching a documentary to draw firm conclusions or reliable conclusions. What I am persuaded of is that the documentary raises serious concerns about the conviction, about the investigation, and more fundamentally about our criminal justice system, because this case, as every case is unique, it's not in some respects. In other respects, it's a familiar story. This is sort of representative, at least parts of it, of a great number of other cases that we see throughout the country where the criminal justice system may have gone awry.
Let's look first at the investigation itself. You're an attorney. You follow these things closely. The documentary lays out all kinds of dynamics here and raises all kinds of questions. Where do you see the biggest questions raised about his ultimate the finding of guilt on Stephen Avery by the docuseries?
You mean assessing the evidence itself?
Yeah, well, as presented in the documentary anyway.
Sure, sure. You know, and again, this is all with a big caveat that I wasn't present at the trial. I haven't seen all of the evidence. I've seen the documentary. But based on that, it does seem to me that there are serious questions about whether there was planting or tampering with the evidence. That's not to say I've drawn a judgment there is, but there are serious questions about that. Perhaps the most troubling aspect of the case, from my perspective, is the way that law enforcement interrogated the guileless 16-year-old Brendan Dassey, leading him to a confession that has all of the hallmarks of what we've come to know as a common feature of wrongful convictions, a false confession. And although that confession is not itself presented as evidence against Stephen Avery, it framed the entire investigation, and it was public knowledge in the community. It's hard to imagine how that did not taint Stephen Avery's trial and conviction. There are some issues that are absolutely worth investigating. There's concerns raised here that I think are very serious about the reliability and validity of the forensic science that was used. We now know from other cases and from a very fundamental report from the National Academy of Sciences in 2009 that most of the forensic sciences we've come to rely on simply aren't very scientific. And this case highlighted that, I think, in pretty dramatic terms.
And when you look at the bigger picture, you take it all the way up to our criminal justice system, questions raised there, like what? How?
Well, there are questions about the role that police play in investigations, about the dynamics at work in prosecutions, the incentives that we give prosecutors, the way we train law enforcement to interrogate in a process that is explicitly guilt presumptive. It's not designed to seek information, but rather to induce a confession statement. We see problems with forensic sciences that are endemic throughout the criminal justice system. In Stephen Avery's first case, we see problems with the way eyewitness identification evidence was collected and used. We now know that among the post-conviction DNA exonerations, that is cases where people convicted of serious crimes were exonerated by DNA evidence, we know that among those cases, the leading cause of wrongful convictions or the leading contributor is simple mistaken eyewitness identifications. We also know that contrary to what the prosecutor in the Brendan Dassey trial, I think somewhat disingenuously told the jury when he said innocent people don't confess, we know that's simply false. They do confess. In fact, again, looking at the DNA exonerations, we know that more than a quarter of the people exonerated by DNA evidence actually confessed falsely to serious crimes. So we see a lot of these things throughout the system, and there's a lot that we can do to try to improve that so that whether Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey are guilty or innocent, we know that these things contribute to other people's wrongful convictions, and we need to do a better job of addressing them.
Plenty of documentaries now diving in on this front of these broader questions, raising doubts and concern in lots of Americans' minds. It makes also can make for very gripping, I hate to use this word, but in some ways, entertainment. Keith Finley, stand by there in Madison, Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Innocence Project. With us from Milwaukee now is Tom Kircher, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He spent years writing about Stephen Avery and the murder of Teresa Halbach, Avery's 2005 arrest in that murder, his subsequent trial and conviction. Tom Kircher, welcome to On Point. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
Many, many viewers of this Netflix docuseries watch it and come away thinking there's been some terrible abuse of justice here, that Stephen Avery should not be sitting in prison for life. You covered the trial. There are questions being raised now about the documentary's slant on all of this. How does the documentary and its emphasis, its focus, line up with what you saw in the trial and your conclusion, Tom?
Well, it's obviously a very thorough piece. I mean, 10 hours devoted to a case is a tremendous amount of time. At the same time, the jury in the Stephen Avery case heard 6 weeks of testimony, so that needs to be kept in mind as well. The film, of course, is really presented from the point of view of Stephen Avery, his family, his lawyers. And so that's another thing viewers need to keep in mind, is that while the film does raise a lot of questions about how the murder case was investigated, it really is presented from that one point of view.
So when people are up in arms around the country thinking there's been a terrible misrepresentation of justice in Wisconsin on this case, do you sympathize with that? Do you think they're on the right beam?
Well, I can tell you on a personal level, well, a couple of things. First of all, the trial, I don't think the guilty verdict at the time back in 2007 came as a shock. There certainly was not anywhere near the outcry there is now about a possible frame-up. Certainly there were plenty of people at the time who followed the trial who believed that the Manitowoc Sheriff's investigators should not have been involved, had opportunities to plant evidence. At the same time, there just was not an outcry when the guilty verdict came down, I think partly because there was so much evidence presented linking Avery to the murder victim, Teresa Halbach. Now, that being said, on a personal level, when I watched the Making a Murderer, I got into about three or four episodes of it and thought, wow, you know, I was there every day. Did all of us in the media miss something? But as I got toward the end of the film and started to review the stories we did at the time of the trial, I could understand why the jury arrived at the guilty verdict.
You can understand it, meaning having covered all of it, in spite of the questions raised in the documentary, you're not putting a fundamental question mark over the ultimate verdict as a reporter who was there?
Well, you know, you made the point there. I'm a reporter. I covered Teresa Halbach's disappearance. I covered Avery, of course, even before that, since his exoneration. Covered the trial, and you know, I'm an observer. I wasn't there. I wasn't a witness. Obviously, I wasn't part of the jury. Now I can relate is what was presented at the trial and why the jury arrived at the verdict it did. It's missed to some extent in the film. I think that while they do present the prosecution side, certainly, again, in terms of balance and focus, I think it's on the film's focus is on the possibility of a frame-up.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the Netflix docuseries Making a Murderer and our new obsession with an old form, the true crime story. It's had a big workout in Serial, in the podcast, in The Jinx, and now from Netflix, Making a Murderer, the story of Stephen Avery and justice delivered or not delivered in Wisconsin. People talking about it all over the country. Keith Findley is with us from the Wisconsin Innocence Project at the University of Wisconsin Law School, represented Stephen Avery in an earlier case that is key to the whole story. We've been talking with Tom Kircher as well, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, who spent years writing about Stephen Avery and the murder of Teresa Halbach, Avery's 2005 arrest and the subsequent trial and conviction. You can join us this hour. Have you binged on this story, on Making a Murderer? Why? What's the appeal here? Is it like a puzzle, an outrage? Do you consider yourself a crusader for justice alongside the filmmakers? Or did the filmmakers potentially themselves get it wrong? Here's just a bit from the third episode of Making a Murderer. Stephen Avery's on the phone conversation with his brother Chuck after he's been sent to prison for the second time here in the murder. Stephen, who's close to giving up hope, says the deck has been stacked against him all along.
Told you, I'm sick of
it. I know you're going through hell, but settle down and settle the mind down. We won't give up on this side.
I'm giving up on this side.
Well, you don't give up on your side either. You just got to hang in there and whatnot.
They're going to win anyway.
No, they're not.
Poor people lose. Poor people lose all the time.
Poor people lose all the time. There are winners here as well. Among them, media outlets looking for stories with a really intriguing angles. In the fourth episode, Making a Murderer, here's a Dateline producer talking to one of the documentary filmmakers about the competitive market these days for murder stories.
Right now, murder is hot. That's what everyone wants. That's what the competition wants. And we're trying to beat out the other networks to get that perfect murder story.
Let's bring our listeners right in here. Lori in Hales Corners, Wisconsin. Lori, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. I am very interested in seeing justice done here. I don't want an innocent person convicted, but, well, there are a lot of flaws here. And my intuition asks the question, could it be that he, who would have killed her? She was over there to interview him and get a story. Could it be that, in fact, that the other side of the possibilities would be that somebody that's close to the police, let's say, convicted, did the crime? So I'm just really, this is very difficult.
Tom Kircher, what do you say to someone like Lori, who's there in Wisconsin, who's been watching all the news coverage for years now, and now all this coming out in the new series? I mean, there is a murder here, and someone did it, and she's not satisfied with sort of, okay, it wasn't him, and off we go. Hello, Tom, are you there?
Yes, sir. I think one thing that to keep in mind is the theories are not mutually exclusive. Some people feel that the evidence is overwhelming against Avery, that he committed the murder, that the guilty verdict is proper. Other people, especially those who are being exposed to the case for the first time through Making a Murderer, feel it was clearly a frame-up. Certainly there's a possibility that both are true, that Avery committed the murder and there was evidence planted. That may be one explanation.
Would the threat of a $36 million judgment against them, how was that seen in Manitowoc County? Would that be ruination for the county? Would there be a giant motivation fiscally to plant something on Stephen Avery that would derail that claim, Tom?
Well, that certainly was heavily pushed by Avery's lawyers that, look, Manitowoc is facing this potential crippling payment to Avery, but how that translates to individual deputies being motivated to plant evidence, I'm not so sure.
Keith Findley, you're very alert to the weaknesses of the justice system. It's not perfect. Maybe none is, and it can look very imperfect when you put the scrutiny of a long documentary series on it. But is it possible that in spite of all those weaknesses and potential flaws, you've still got the murderer in jail right now?
Oh, certainly it's possible. But of course, our criminal justice system isn't built on the principle of putting people in prison based on possibilities. It's based on the principle of putting people in prison when you can prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And obviously, the jury in this case was satisfied that the prosecution had met that burden when they rendered their verdict. The question now, though, is whether enough new evidence has come to light to render that verdict sufficiently suspect as to require a new trial. And then as to the question of who else may have done it, at this point it would be wild speculation. I know from Stephen Avery's trial attorneys that their view is that there were a number of people who are possible alternative suspects who had similar opportunities and access to the property and to Teresa Halbach who could have done it. But they also say, I think quite responsibly, that it would be highly inappropriate for them to start speculating publicly or naming individuals, both because it's not fair to the integrity of the investigation, but also because it wouldn't be fair to those individuals at this point. But suffice it to say that there is enough there that there are other people who could be investigated and who could have done it.
Dennis in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Dennis, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I don't know whether Stephen Avery is guilty or innocent, but someone murdered Teresa Halbach at or near his home, planted evidence, burned her body, and nobody saw any of this happen. That's my only comment.
The body was there. It's on the property. And, Tom, many people look at this and say it's hard to believe that that would be just happening without the family or even Avery himself knowing about it.
Well, you have to picture a rural area in Wisconsin, a sprawling property with a salvage yard and some homes dotted about. But it's not a place where people are passing by regularly. A person shows up to take a photograph. How long would it take for something to happen? I don't know. One thing about the last couple of callers that I think I'm observing is when Making a Murderer first was released and people were starting to watch it, I think there was this tremendous reaction of this was planted evidence, this was a frame-up. And I feel like that opinion is starting to evolve a little bit, whether it's people commenting on shows like this or on Twitter, some articles in the media. You're getting more people questioning it now. They're recognizing that, look, this is told from the defense perspective. They raise many excellent questions. At the same time, people are saying, now, wait a minute, you know, what was the evidence in the trial? And there's a little bit more of, I think, critical thinking going on, certainly worries, big worries about how the case was investigated, but maybe not quite the certainty, if you will, that Ms. Justice was carried out.
Keith, I've just got you for another minute. You're with the Wisconsin Innocence Project. Of course, Stephen Avery has now filed a motion from prison, hoping to get some relief here, maybe end up out. Do you think there's enough on the table that he'll get some kind of relief or revisiting of the whole case?
Well, again, I don't think any of us knows the answer to that question yet. That will be to get there will require a significant investment of investigative resources. His new attorneys are working on that. So I think that's yet to be seen. If I could, just yes, really briefly, I'd just like to react to one thing that Tom Kircher has said about this being told from the perspective of the defense, and I think he's absolutely right about that. Some people see that as a criticism. I'd just like to offer the counterpoint that I'm not sure that's a criticism of the documentary. That may, in fact, be a strength of the documentary, because so much of this story, until this documentary came out, was really quite rabid, hateful. For Stephen Avery, conclusions that he was absolutely guilty. And the documentary, I think, does us a service by not only showing an alternative perspective, but also of showing us the inside of what it looks like to someone who's been sort of caricatured as a monster, a soulless individual, and showing us that, in fact, he's a common poor person who has feelings, he has family, that things are always complex. So if, in fact, it is told from the defense perspective, I think that's a unique perspective that hasn't been heard to date and that is a very important, actually important component of this documentary.
Getting more complicated as voices chime in all over social media and others as well. Stephen Avery's ex-fiancee, Jody Stokowski, talked about abuse in her 2-year relationship with him. We've seen her smiling and supporting him, but with Headline News last week, she said she'd been afraid to tell what she knew to the documentarians.
He beat me all the time, punch me, throw me against the wall. I try to leave, he smashed the windshield out of my car so I couldn't leave him.
But of course, it's what matters in a court of law that is the last word, or maybe it's not. Things are really moving and changing as media and now social media gets really involved here, almost participatory justice with people in there. Who knows? Netflix doesn't release the numbers, but maybe millions watching this and ending up kind of commentators and participants themselves. Keith Findley with the Wisconsin Innocence Project, thanks very much for being with us today from Madison. Thank you for coming in for a minute here.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Tom Kircher, please stand by in Milwaukee. Michelle Dean joins us right now from New York City, culture critic and reporter for The Guardian. Her beat is crime and books and religion. Michelle, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
And from New York City, Jack Murtha is here, writes about the media for the Columbia Journalism Review. Jack Murtha, thank you for being with us today.
Hi, Tom.
What do you think of this documentary as a piece of journalism? Do you look at it and see journalism, or is this drama? Is it entertainment? How do you look at it, Jack?
Well, I think the quality of the journalism here is a little bit murky because it clearly is a piece of entertainment, as harsh as that may sound for the Halbach family. You know, this is a 10-part series on Netflix that is designed to not only draw viewers, but to keep them coming back. Now, I do think that there can be some strong journalism in this documentary, and there clearly is. You have these news perspectives coming out, these things that were kind of kept under the rug, but this big common complaint that this was one-sided, you know, it is an issue. When you have so many viewers coming away drawing these big, grandiose conclusions, you can't help but question what the goal was here. That said, the filmmakers did try to get the Halbach family to participate, and they did try to get the prosecution to no avail.
And yet, documentaries have for a long time set out to expose, illuminate, crusade, turn the lights on. I mean, it's not new at all for a documentary to have a point of view or come to a conclusion.
No, not at all. And actually, it probably wouldn't be a very good documentary if it didn't have a set story and, you know, a particular point of view. Instead, that would be something more like what we see in the daily coverage of the trial itself.
Michelle Dean, what do you think is driving this, apparently, this renewed appetite for this kind of true crime story? I mean, true crime stories have been around forever. Pulp, all the way back to sort of the beginning of modern media. But now there's this new wave of interest in these stories, Serial, The Jinx, this one. What's driving that?
Well, I don't think that true crime itself is enjoying a renaissance as a genre for reasons, you know, that it's more resonant about the justice system. I think it's because of what you were mentioning about this participatory social media element. And I think people are really responding to the ability to get online and argue about this and argue about, you know, who else could have been responsible for these crimes or who or whether people are innocent or guilty. And that's been very addictive for a lot of people. And we've seen it in Serial. We've seen it in The Jinx, possibly to a lesser extent. And we've also seen it with this documentary.
Tom Kircher, as a reporter, do you see the participatory face of this? Lots of people watching these cases when they get media exposure and jumping in with their own commentary, their own conclusions, their own questions, even their own investigation.
Well, that's a huge part of feeding the popularity, I think. You know, I give credit to the filmmakers for staying with the project for 10 years, and I think, gee, what if they did have the fortune of selling their work to, let's say, a cable channel 8 or 10 years ago. Maybe it would have been aired for 2 hours, maybe 10, I don't know, but it's hard to imagine it making the kind of impact it did. Now, here we are 10 years later. The case is old enough that it's almost fresh, if you will, and people have this bingeability factor, being able to watch it on Netflix, and then with the surge in popularity of social media, it's just continued to feed the popularity.
Let's go to Carl in Omaha, Nebraska. Carl, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Big fan.
Great. What do you think, Carl?
My question was, how do you feel these types of documentaries, along with CSI and Law and Order, have an effect on the beyond a reasonable doubt? Do you think that those shows push past what we can reasonably, scientifically, or forensically achieve in 2016?
That is interesting. Do they, in effect, raise the burden of proof in cases before the courts? Tom Kircher, you cover this zone. What do you say?
You know, I think what I'm not sure about how to answer the question, but what I think is important in one of the important parts of making a murder is that it really has raised the awareness of people who perhaps don't know much about how a murder is investigated, don't know much about how evidence is presented at trial. And I think those are excellent benefits of this series. And that's what the filmmaker said was their goal, was not to come in and determine whether Stephen Avery is guilty or innocent of the murder, but to shine a light on the system and how it works. And I think on that level, it makes a great contribution. The question still becomes how fair, how balanced is their presentation? And Keith Finley with the Innocence Project mentioned earlier that they offer a unique insight, and I agree. At the same time, how would the film have been different had the filmmakers been embedded, if you will, with the Hallback family and the prosecution as opposed to the Avery family?
Michelle, can you see media coverage like this, raising the burden of proof in cases, prosecutors thinking, you know, I don't just need to convince a jury, I need to come up with a verdict that would stand the test of a kind of making a murderer treatment?
Well, I think most prosecutors know that media coverage is an integral part of what they do. And I'm not sure. I do think that they have been unprepared, perhaps, for, again, what I would call the participatory social media element. But I don't know that it would. It certainly doesn't necessarily change the laws of evidence. What it does mean is that if a prosecutor puts on a case that is shaky, it is something they're going to have to consider down the road. And I think you're going to see them be more reluctant to participate in some of these projects.
This On Point podcast is made possible by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace websites help you capture every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com. When you're ready to purchase, use the one-word offer code ONPOINT to save 10%. You should. Squarespace.
Hi, it's Tom. With a quick heads up for you, be sure to stay with us to the end of this podcast for a sneak preview of Modern Love. It's WBUR's new podcast put together in collaboration with the New York Times. You may want to check it out. Thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Netflix docuseries Making a Murderer and our new obsession with an old form, the true crime story, maybe more importantly, whether or not justice has been done, and the way these podcast documentaries can come in, put a huge investment of time and detail out on the table for all to see. In the era of social media, citizens become participants in justice in a way they maybe never quite have before. Tom Kircher joins us today from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He spent years writing about Stephen Avery, the man at the heart of the Making a Murderer story. He covered the murder of Teresa Halbach that Stephen Avery is in prison for life for as we speak, about his 2005 arrest, the subsequent trial and conviction. Michelle Dean is with us from New York, cultural critic, reporter for The Guardian. Jack Murth is with us from the Columbia Journalism Review. You can join us as well. What do you think? Do we have all these shows now, Making a Murderer, Serial, The Jinx, and so on, because our justice system is a mess? Or because they make irresistible stories? Or both? And what journalistic standards should these filmmakers, podcasters be held to? Are they hitting it? One of the filmmakers, Laura Ricciardi, behind Making a Murderer, earlier this month talked with my NPR colleague Renee Montaigne, who asked her if she thought Stephen Avery was innocent of the murder of which he was convicted.
My opinion is we don't know. There were so many questions about the quality of the investigation itself here. There was a glaring conflict of interest in this particular case. Stephen Avery had a $36 million lawsuit pending against this county and former members of law enforcement. And here he was back in the same system, charged with a serious crime.
There's the Making a Murderer set up. Here's Sarah Koenig, host of the big hit podcast Serial, told the story of Adnan Syed, who was convicted of killing his high school girlfriend, Haemin Lee. Faced with competing accounts on that murder from Adnan and Jay, a key witness, Koenig explains here in this bit why she wanted to get to the bottom of that case.
What I took away from the visit was, somebody is lying here. Maybe Adnan really is innocent, but what if he isn't? What if he did do it, and he's got all these good people thinking he didn't? So either it's Jay or it's Adnan, but someone is lying, and I really wanted to figure out who.
There's Sarah Koenig from Serial. Michelle Dean in New York City. Lots of people listen to Serial. Lots and lots of Watchmaking a Murderer. What's your sense of how the motivations for the podcast creator or the filmmaker here works? I mean, these documentarians spent 10 years. That's a huge commitment. It would seem strange to think that they came into this, you know, at the beginning of that with the end in mind necessarily. Can you see them coming in, staying objective, staying fair throughout?
I mean, a 10-year investment in reporting a case is extraordinary. And no, it's difficult to see a situation where a reporter would remain completely unemotionally invested in what's happening. I don't know, though, that means that the reporting isn't good or is questionable on that basis.
You know, Jack, we had in The New Yorker this piece by Catherine Schultz, who looks very carefully at how the Making a Murderer story, the Stephen Avery story, is presented. And she says in the end that what she sees here is that this approach swaps one absolute for another, and in so doing comes to resemble the system it seeks to correct. She's kind of ends up critical of both sides of the equation here. Maybe these stories are so layered and so impenetrable that it's impossible to come out looking like the blindfolded lady holding the perfectly balanced scales of justice, Jack.
Well, we definitely seem to like to boil these things down to, you know, one side or the other when, of course, there's a lot of nuance in anything. I read the New Yorker piece, and I think a lot of it was well written, well argued, except this idea that these filmmakers went in with a particular intent. We can never get inside their heads. They have said that they just went in wanting to investigate this and hoping to expose these flaws in the criminal justice system. Now, any journalist who claims to hold on to total objectivity, especially throughout a reporting project that's this long, is just bluffing. We can't really tell exactly what they were thinking, but we can kind of look at the end product and we can come away with a takeaway. And it seems clear to me that they were pushing a little bit more for Avery and for Dassey. Now, does that mean they think he's innocent? No, of course not. But that's the point of view they chose to take. They can't necessarily control how their audience will react to that and how they will take that to social media.
Judy in Buffalo, New York. Judy, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I'm not sure if it was Tom or Keith who a while back used the phrase, when speaking of prosecutors, of incentives for prosecutors. But I think that has a lot to do with this case and many cases and what's wrong with our criminal justice system. And I'd like to hear some opinions. I don't think the general public realizes how much power that the prosecutor wields, almost more in some cases than the judge. And it seems like that blind lady holding the scale of justice has almost gone out the window. And it seems that there are a lot of incentives for prosecutors out there. And I'd like to hear some commentary about that.
Well, like what, Judy? Where's your skepticism there? I mean, their incentive is supposed to be justice. What else would there be?
Their incentive is supposed to be justice. Their incentive could be re-election. Their incentive could be, you know, bringing enough cases to trial without mm-hmm. really investigating or having enough of the evidence. I think those kinds of things.
Tom Kircher, this is in your wheelhouse. You cover a lot for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, have over the years. What about the role prosecutors play, the power that they have in their incentives?
Well, prosecutors certainly have lots of power. They've got tremendous resources. In this case, you know, you had a couple of sheriff's departments involved in the investigation. The FBI was involved, the State Crime Lab, the Department of Justice. So they've got a lot of resources to bring to bear. And, you know, in terms of incentive, certainly they want to win cases. They, you know, believe that they've charged the right person and you know, want to see that person convicted. I wonder if we're about to see another pivot, though, with regard to public opinion on this. You know, I think initially the very strong reaction to the movie was that Stephen Avery was framed. I mentioned earlier, I feel like that's evolving a little bit to where now people are questioning the film a little bit more, as well as the evidence. And I wonder if the next step is Brendan Dassey. You know, the focus has been so much on Stephen Avery, but Brendan Dassey, who was 16 years old at the time, some limited cognitive abilities. In terms of the justice system, people are raising a lot of questions about, did he have adequate representation? Was he interrogated fairly? That sort of thing. And I wonder if that's the next focus of all this.
Here's a little bit from the series. Brendan Dassey, also convicted in Teresa Halbach's murder. His first lawyer, Lee Kaczynski, removed from the Dassey case by the judge after he allowed Dassey to be interrogated by the police without a lawyer present. He's portrayed in the film as helping the prosecution almost more than Dassey, his client. And here's a scene from the fourth episode, Making a Murderer, where the attorney's hired interrogator, Michael O'Kelly, who should be working for Dassey, is kind of eliciting a confession.
Are you sorry? If you're not sorry, I can't help you. What I don't want you to do is spend the rest of your life in prison. Do you want to spend the rest of your life in prison? You did a very bad thing.
Yeah, but I was only there for the fire, though.
Brendan, you haven't told me the truth yet. And what I don't want you to do right now is tell me any more lies.
Working for Dassey's attorney? I don't know. Ray in Milwaukee. Ray, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'm probably one of the few people in the country who have not seen this series, so my comments will be from my memory, and I am a news junkie, and I followed this case very, very closely
okay.
when it all was happening.
Yep.
I'm really glad you just played also Stephen Avery's ex-wife and that he was violent towards women, which obviously didn't come out in the series, but the way it wound up in the end that he is in jail, and during his trial, I feel if somebody else had burned that body and put it in that burn pit, which was right outside his trailer, if he himself had not done the killing, he definitely knew which one of his probably family members or nearby neighbors did this horrible crime, and he said nothing to defend himself. All he kept saying was, I'm being framed. Well, he should have had some ideas how this poor woman's body got into his burn barrel. And the other things about the criminal justice system, our criminal justice system in this country is a joke from the bottom, the smallest courts, to the Supreme Court. It is a total farce.
That's a giant statement, Ray. What leads you to say that? And you didn't even watch this documentary, which casts a lot of doubt here. I mean, that's a pretty broad stroke there.
I live in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Tom, where 150-some murders happened this year. Why don't we see some documentaries about police shooting black people in the city of Milwaukee? Why don't we have documentaries about poor black people being in jail for presumably killing white people? No, this is a white guy and a white girl. This is totally done for the titillation of, you know, people across the nation now are all wrapped up in this. We should be more outraged by the daily killings and the police brutality towards people they're supposed to be protecting. The whole system is completely a joke.
Ray, we've got it. Michelle Dean, you trained as a lawyer. You can see the kind of this isn't just from Making a Murderer. Ray hasn't even seen it, but you can hear people kind of leaning toward this notion of, wow, it's all so difficult, and it's also filled with the cross currents of motivation. He's prepared to say the whole criminal justice system is a joke, and pretty soon you've got real trouble with public confidence. Do you think this kind of scrutiny and engagement, when people get on social media and get closely involved, will end up leading to greater confidence or reform or changes, or does it just lead to disillusionment?
Well, I think we don't know that yet. You know, I think that the disillusionment is pretty easy spiral to get into. And I think this, you know, I did train as a lawyer, although I work mostly as a journalist now. Mm-hmm. And I think that disillusionment is very familiar to me from being a law student and from sort of actually looking at the law. And then eventually you build a confidence back up in it after, you know, a certain amount of practice. But I think that, you know, ultimately, I don't know that this debate on social media is actually going anywhere productive. I mean, earlier we were talking about the defense attorneys being afraid to name alternative suspects. But if you look at any of the social media reaction to this, you will see people actually naming these people and in some cases contacting them and trying to talk to them. So it seems to me people are investigating the cases, but they aren't necessarily investigating the system.
Jack, you've got, again, in the New Yorker story, Catherine Schultz talking about people who are getting called out like that by citizens or observers in social media naming potential alternative murderers here. And you say, she says, for those people called out like that without a trial, making a murderer seems, quoting here, less like investigative journalism and more like highbrow vigilante justice, Jack.
Yeah, well, this is something that we certainly see on the internet beyond just true crime documentaries. You know, after the Boston bombing, we had a Reddit trying to solve the case. This is something that's clearly a problem when it comes down to naming people. But I think that the bigger fault lies when journalistic organizations take those investigations as fact, which one of the tabloids in New York City did do here after the Boston bombing. I'm not sure that there's much control on the part of the journalist to prevent that type of amateur investigation from happening. You know, you put out a documentary, you hope that it sparks conversation, you hope that it gets people to think about these things going on in the world. But I doubt that there are many journalists who would like to see people potentially harassing others online.
Tom Kircher, how's it feel when you've got the social media over your shoulder, watching what's unfolding, watching your reporting, maybe even just online and beyond online, doing their own investigation, and then giving a kind of a commentary stream or challenges over your shoulder as you're reporting?
You know, some of it is helpful, honestly. It's not unlike a colleague or a friend discussing your work and making observations and maybe raising things that you hadn't thought of before. So at the same time, I mean, some of the breathless reaction to this, I don't know, that is helpful. You know, when people say making a murder raises a lot of great questions about how the system works and should some changes be made, you know, that's great. But to leap to a conclusion that the whole system is junk, is wrecked, doesn't work anymore, is a little hard to take.
Michelle, do you see more of this coming? These have been so popular. I assume that more people will dive in and that this, at least for some period here, becomes a steady part of our diet, media diet.
Yeah. I mean, I think more are coming. And I think also most people, or most of the crime reporters I know, including myself, see this sort of appetite for these stories just exploding. And I think it's just going to continue indefinitely.
Well, I'm here to hope, I guess, that over time, transparency should work toward greater justice. Try and keep the bearings straight for those doing the reporting. Of course, they can go off the rails just like a prosecution can. Maybe with everybody watching online and commenting online, that's a kind of guard against getting out of whack as well. Grateful to all three of you for helping us look at making a murderer. Tom Kircher with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, who's covered this for so many years. Tom, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Michelle Dean at The Guardian in New York. Michelle, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
And Jack Murtha with the Columbia Journalism Review. Thanks for joining us, Jack.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Let's face it, when have you ever been in a relationship that's gone as planned?
Sometimes I think about the vows my wife and I made to each other 28 years ago, and we're different people than we once were.
And I don't even like him, I said, wiping my tears. He's a liar. I can't spend the rest of my life with him.
Being wheeled into surgery like this, alongside a woman in a sexy dress, pretty much screamed sex injury.
Modern Love, popular New York Times column, is coming to you as a podcast.
There is no good way to tell a new guy in your life that you're going blind.
Between these two genteel southern ladies, our family became an old west town. It just wasn't big enough for both of them.
Starring some familiar voices.
Hey, this is Emmy Rossum.
Hi, this is Jason Alexander.
Hey, it's January Jones.
Hey, it's Judd Apatow here.
Modern Love will make you laugh.
Is everything all right up there?
It'll make you cry.
I started calling hospitals, then morgues.
It'll make you think.
We can't keep calling you daddy, he said, if you're gonna be a girl. It's too weird.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and I'll be your host. Modern Love, the podcast, is a collaboration between the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. Stories of love,
loss, and redemption.
You're off the hook, I said. No guilt.
I love you. I love you too.
Modern Love, a new episode every Thursday. Subscribe today on iTunes and fall in love at first listen.